I'm getting some nods. I'm getting some blank looks. But yes, this is the session. So, a little bit about me first. My name's Liam, as you can tell. I'm from West Virginia. I work for Susketech as a solution architect. Bit of SharePoint MVP for a while. I work with SharePoint for way too many years that I like to think of. And I work on all kinds of SharePoint stuff. So you have my contact details if you want to email me, whatever else. So what are we going to talk about? Let me talk about with the premise of why we wanted to speak about this first. I'm just going to flick screens. I actually thought that was me then when I pressed the button. Wow. So the premise of the session was based around something like this. Anybody ever seen this website? That's a good thing. It's a website called Shodan HQ. It's not made for, I'll use the word normal people. This is made for you to find vulnerable websites, find vulnerable devices. Let's see if we can find some Cisco devices on the network somewhere across the internet. This one, I did a quick search. I do a search for SharePoint. Look how many there is. So if we look on the list, there's 59,000 of them in the US. Now what this means is that if I was a hacker, I would go here first. And I would see, I get some IP addresses, and I can then open some of the IP addresses and think, well, what about if I go to this one? Okay, so I'm going to go to a page. It's called SP Disco. It lists you all of the web service URLs that are available in a SharePoint site that's publicly available to use. Doesn't mean you have permission, but they're available. So I'm thinking, well, what can I do next? So what about if we pick some other websites that might be available? Here's one. It's an anonymous website. I can see the view lists. You're not going to stand there for long enough. I get this fantastic one here. Oh, look at that. I get a whole bunch of email addresses. I get a whole bunch of PowerPoints. Now, notice I'm not spending a lot of time on that website. there's a few reasons for that one. You might have seen that in the URL. That's not what I'm not going to go on. But that's the premise of the session. The premise of the session was, I can do this, so can you. If your website, intranet, extranet, is misconfigured, it shows up like this. And then you can start brute force attacking. So what we're going to talk about, it's all about security. So we can talk about authentication, authorization. We can talk about claims. Who loves claims? Well, there's a few people who are really excited, and the rest of you, nothing. So hopefully you'll embrace the claims. You'll come to give it a group hug. Talk about OAuth. Oh, look at that. You need to come up here. Talk about OAuth. We're going to talk about protecting content, what that means, what we can do. Talk about protecting the infrastructure, because that's quite important. If the infrastructure is not protected, then little people like me can just hop in and do whatever we need to. And then, of course, last but not least, we'll talk about some kind of compliance. So let's talk about authentication authorization. So what types do we support in SharePoint? You should all know this one. This is like a recap. Windows. Who's using Windows authentication for their SharePoint site? It's got to be at least everybody in the room. Because if you're admins, you have to use Windows Auth to get in, so you're using Windows. Forms-based authentication. So we're talking generally three different types. We're talking LDAP, we're talking SQL Server, we're talking ASP.NET membership providers. It's the standard .NET core components that we're using for authentication. Then we have this really weird one called SAML. And SAML kind of covers a whole bunch of different things. And SharePoint doesn't really support SAML. Not really, but it likes to think it does. But you can make it kind of go together fairly well. It's like my children. I have a daughter and a son, and they kind of love each other, but they also hate each other. It's kind of that fighting relationship. SharePoint's kind of like that with SAML. So we have federated services. We're going to talk about this today. Federated services, fantastic. Third-party custom authentication, identity providers, LDAP providers, and then, of course, we can do Windows Azure Access Control services, which you have all used today at least once, if not at one point during the conference. Every time you go to MySPC and you log in and choose Windows Live, it redirects you to Hub Auth at Microsoft. That's Windows Azure, and you're logging in through an ACS and then being transferred back to the site. So it works. It works really, really well. And then we'll talk about some OAuth, this new idea of server to server and the application model. We'll talk about what that means for looking after content and for securing a SharePoint environment. So let's talk about this a bit more in detail. We could do like a kind of a boxing match between the two. I feel really short when I'm behind here. I walk past, I'm like, there's nobody there. I'm going to stand over here, and then I'm going to run that way. So, authentication. What is authentication? Authentication is verification of a claim. Who in this room thinks SharePoint does authentication? Oh, that's beautiful. Beautiful. That's the correct answer. SharePoint does not do authentication at all. In fact, it has no idea about authentication. Authentication is offloaded somewhere else. Even when your end user says, I can't log into SharePoint, they're not trying to log into SharePoint, they're trying to log into an Active Directory that's sending them back to SharePoint at that point. Authorization. This is what SharePoint does. SharePoint's great at this. You throw it some stuff and it says, no, go away. Or it says, yes, come in. It's authorization of a claim object that's been presented back from an attribute store of some description. For 90% of us, it's Active Directory. It's a token that's sent back. So, the basic example that we use, that was quick. The basic example is you go to the bank. You go to the bank and you want to get some money out the bank. So you turn up at the desk at the teller, and what do? She's going to say, well, what's your account number? And then she's going to say, well, can I have your ID? And you give her the ID, and then she checks the account number, matches the ID, and then you're authorized to do something. It's exactly how SharePoint works. You're passing something back. That's what authorization. The authentication piece is before the authorization. However, this always takes up. There we go. There's an exception to the rule. Anonymous posting of blog comments. You're not authenticated, are you? You're actually authorized as an anonymous to post blog comments. And anonymous users are kind of already authorized based on not being authenticated. So there's an exception to the rule when it comes to the web, which is a little bit different. So, and this is one thing that we often forget. Authentication gets broken all the time. All the time. Famous story, WikiLeaks. Everybody's heard the WikiLeaks one. How did he get the stuff out of the internal system? Where was the stuff stored? Do you know the stuff that the one guy got was in SharePoint? And how did he get the stuff out? He wrote scripts that would go against the SharePoint server in the environment and take stuff out. But he was inside. It wasn't a hack, he was inside the network. But of course, none of your users are hackers, are they? I know that IT staff are hackers. We all like to think of ourselves as little bitty hackers. But no, that's where stuff was stored. So there's a bit of an issue here of authentication, permission, and authorization. This is obviously something we're going to go through. Authorization is a little bit more complicated to break. Why? Because the authorization is done at the source of the application that you're trying to get to. So once you've authenticated, you have the token, then there's a sealed token that gets passed between. It's a lot more complicated to break open an Active Directory token and try and hack it. So how does the authentication process work? Well, this is very straightforward. You will have all seen this process, hopefully. So there we go. You make a request from your machine, your workstation, you say, get me SharePoint. And then SharePoint gets it and says, hold on a minute, I have no idea who you are. So it requests an authentication process and says, hey, go back, go and validate who you are. Now notice, this isn't the server side, this is thrown back to you at the client. So your browser is sent a request from SharePoint that says, what do you do? Now luckily for you, you're on the network, so your machine's already authenticated, so you often have cache credentials, which then get circulated back, and then, excuse me, the authent request is sent, a security token is then requested from the STS inside SharePoint. So you have this authentication token, you have the STS, they come together, they have a few candles, play some music, get together, and after they've spent some time together, they send a security token request back. So the token comes back, you get a service token, everything's wrapped up together in a nice little bundle, and the resource is sent with that requested token. You don't actually see this. You never see this. And anybody who tried to do a fiddler trace, you will never see this. This is all internal processes that take place. Now, if you change the process slightly and you go a different way, which I'll talk about later, you start to get redirects and all kind of bounds everywhere. So we'll talk about that in a minute. So, authorization. SharePoint does this after the authentication. And authorization is really around three things. Is the user a member of something? Is the user account added to the ACL of whatever you're trying to get to, a Word document, a PowerPoint, a site, the whole group? Does the user have the required attribute? Because we're talking claims now. So a claim is just a bunch of attributes squashed together, and SharePoint needs to kind of open those up and say, hey, which one do you have? SharePoint only understands what it's told. I tell people, you might think that's a very simple statement to make, but it is. If you haven't given me permission, I won't be able to get in. If you've given the permission to the wrong security group, and I'm not in that group, I can't get in. Or if you've said domain users, full control, that's going to be fun. What happened to the front page? Well, I didn't like it, so I deleted it. So if you make a mistake, you've just opened up your entire environment to being messed with. Not that intentionally somebody would do that, but that's what happens. So the best approach for authorization, we're not going to start sticking individual users in. We're going to use groups and roles. We're going to use claim attributes. We're going to put these in as objects. We're not going to shove 5,000 users just willy-nilly into the site. We used to do that in NTFS shares. You used to just add random permissions all over the place and then wonder why Steve had access to everything when he wasn't supposed to. And one of the first jobs we used to get was come in and do an audit and go, why has Steve got access to everything? He works in the mailroom. Why has he got permission? Well, he called up and said he had to have permission, so I gave it to him. That happens quite frequently, part of that new social engineering thing. So let's talk about claims. I like claims. I think this was a great advent to Microsoft, to SharePoint. This is something that was well needed. So let's talk about some fundamentals of claims. We're going to talk about some specific things, then we'll talk about process flows. So what are the key words we need to know? Identity. And yes, there's a driving license that I found on the website. Identity. We're going to match it to a driving license. This is the person. This is you as the individual or your end user or somebody coming from outside, a Facebook user coming to SharePoint, whatever it might be. That's the identity of the person. Then we have the actual claims themselves. In the driving license instance, it's height, eye color, shoe size, whatever you want it to be. Those are claim attributes that come back. And then, of course, we have the token itself. The token is the binary representation of the identity. So you go and authenticate to Facebook. Facebook wraps it up into a token, throws it back, squashes all of the claim attributes inside, and signs it with a certificate and says, hey, this is you. It's very, very clever. Then we send that to the relying party, which is what you're trying to do. The relying party is what you want to get to. I'm trying to get to this. I'm trying to get to that. And the user token gets wrapped up into that relying party. And then, of course, we have the secure store, the STS. This is the one that basically reissues. So think of the process. You go and log in at Facebook. You come all the way back. It wraps it all up in a neat little package. SharePoint throws it to the STS. The STS says, hold on a minute. Whoop, wrap it up again. And then that gets issued back to SharePoint. That's how that process works. It's very secure. It's great. And what's even better is you just dump the authentication somewhere else. You don't have to own the usernames and passwords. You don't have to have spreadsheets of usernames like loads of people that I know. Yeah, I've got all my users in a spreadsheet. We don't need to use that. So how does the processing work? Let's see how it fundamentally works. So we have our identity mechanism. I'll stick with the Facebook one for now. Is there anybody in the room who doesn't have a Facebook account? Wow. Two? No? Three? Four? Five? Oh, now it's all correct. No, I haven't got one. I'm not cool enough for that. Facebook. Great one. It's an identity provider. That's all it is. So, we got a Facebook. We log in. What does it do? It sends stuff in and out to SharePoint. SharePoint has its own STS to handle the claims coming back in again. So what does it do? It comes in, it sends a token, we process it, and then a couple of things can happen. We have these two little boxes of things that we can do. The first one is transformation. We can transform something that's coming in to be something else. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, well, in Facebook, Well, let's use Windows Live. Everyone's got a Windows Live ID or something. Windows Live ID, they use the user principal name as the object for authentication. That means nothing to me. SharePoint looks at it and goes, what is a UPN? Like, I have the end user would look at it and go, well, that's cool. That looks like my email address, but I have no idea. But what they're interested in is the username that they used for logging in. So what can we do? We can take an acclaim that comes in and transpose that to something else. So we have that capability inside SharePoint to do that one, and at the identity provider level. The next one is augmentation. This is fantastic. Augmentation is glorious. What we're able to do is when you log in, how cool would it be? You know, this kind of magic nirvana of I can get everything about me in one go. So when I log in, I can go and get everything I need. This is what augmentation's for. I log in, I come from Facebook, I get some claims, and then what I do is when I log into SharePoint, I actually go and make a call to PeopleSoft and get some other information from PeopleSoft, and I inject those into the claim objects as outputs, and then when SharePoint gets my claim object, I get Facebook stuff and my PeopleSoft data at the same time. Now I don't have to make multiple calls. So historically, in 2007, and in 2010 if you weren't using this, you would use ASP.NET membership providers, and what would happen is, 9 times out of 10, you would make an authentication request, you would go in, and then you would have custom code in the SharePoint side that would then make web service calls to go and get the data that you need to. And all it was address or something silly. Now you can do that in the process of the authentication. So once we get all that stuff in the provider, it squashes it over to SharePoint. SharePoint can do augmentation too based on custom code. And then happily, it throws it to the SP security model in SharePoint. And if all goes well, you'll get access to the site. It's very, very clever. But it doesn't just stop there. So how does the pipeline work for claims? So you have this process of I come in, I do this, I get claims, I augment, I get published straight into SharePoint. So how does the pipeline work? We take the incoming claim. This is important. This is how it processes it. The claims come in. So a claim attribute would be the user principal name. It comes in. It goes to stage one. So stage one. There's three effective stages in a claims pipeline. So for this example, let's talk about ADFS. ADFS is really easy to map to this because you actually have tabs in the interface that match to these three approaches. The first one is the acceptance rules. So how am I going to accept you coming in? What is it that says Liam has access? Once we've passed that process, it goes to stage two. And then it's authorization process. How do we authorize you? And the authorization process does one of two things. It permits or denies based on some attribute that's been associated. And once you've gone through this process, then we go to stage three, and then we have the issuance of the tokens or the rules that come back. So I'll show you this in ADFS, the three processes to go through. This is how claims works. So it's very, very clever. So at any point in this kind of structure, you can throw people out. They might not get past stage one, because stage one, I've validated myself. Let's say I'm a hacker. I've managed to reconstruct a Facebook security packet, and I'm sending it over to SharePoint. What's the first thing that's going to happen? It's going to hit SharePoint and go, oh, Facebook, cool. And then it's going to go, what certificate did you use for sign-in? And then it's going to go, you don't have the certificate. And throw you out. But if you have the right certificate, because you have come from Facebook, then it's going to go to stage two and say, well, hold on a minute. What do you belong to? Do you have the right claim? Do you actually have that claim from Facebook? Do you have an email address associated that we're specifically applying permissions to? And then, of course, stage three, it then issues and wraps everything back. So it's a very important concept to understand of how the pipeline works for SharePoint. And then we get access. So what about augmentation? What is augmentation for? It's the ability to intercept the incoming claims and to transform them, to different outgoing ones. It also allows us to kind of add extra attributes and have them generated on the fly as part of that process. Why would you need to augment? Well, think about it logically. You generally do want to get more information about somebody when they log in. So think of a public-facing website that you would want them to log into. You've all been to websites where you have to log in. Wouldn't it be good to just if they happen to be trusted from Facebook and you have their address, that you can just pre-populate forms with that data. That's what that process is for. It allows you to go through and retrieve user attributes. Now, what are the types of augmentation? So we have some different types. We have the Federation Gateway, and this one is kind of, we talk about the whole Facebook idea. This is claim mapping transformation, incoming to outgoing. Just do a straight boom, boom. You can do a same as incoming, so you can say if this one's called Bob, it's going to be called Bob on the way back out again. Then, of course, you have the two other options. You have the claim mapping, which is exactly the same, but that's specifically SharePoint. And then you have the appending process, appending and injecting claims as part of the augmentation. So what will you see? You will have all seen these, hopefully. This is a recap for you. Anybody seen something like that? Yeah? Do you think that's fantastic? The end user looks at it and goes, what is that? Just some random thing on the end. But it actually makes pretty good sense. What's the I? Well, the I determines it's an identity claim. That's what the letters mean. I, identity. Then we have the little zero is actually reserved. But in 2013, it's now available for you to use. In 2010, it was reserved and you couldn't do anything with it. Now in 2013, you're able to write custom claim providers that write their own and attach to specific claim prefixes. But you also have the hash, which is the user login name. You have the what type it is. It's a type of string. Then you have the F, because this is the forms account. And then, of course, we break it out. We have the membership provider name, because you might be using a .NET provider. And then, of course, we have the actual account itself. When you actually see it like this, it kind of makes sense. Identity, this one, type of string, everything else. So what about this one? This is probably one you've seen more often. It's a domain account added to SharePoint. Same kind of process, I for identity, reserved again, user login account, we've got a type of string, this time W for Windows, F before for form, W for Windows, and then of course we have the domain account. And then of course, last but not least, my favorite is if I was using Windows Azure on a custom identity provider. This one's a little bit different. So we have the I again. Notice we have a different, we have 05 this time. 5 is for an email type, because I'm using Windows Azure. There's actually a list of all these. The type of string, trusted identity, so we're using T, so you've got F and W and T, so T for trusted identity. Then, of course, we have, in this case, we have the provider name, which is Windows Azure, or it could be My Identity Provider or Facebook or whatever you want it to be. And then, of course, we have the actual email or account that's being used. It makes sense when you break it down to smaller chunks. It's to make sure that you get unique objects coming back into SharePoint. So, what about OAuth? Everybody familiar with it now? They're going to embrace it like claims? OAuth is quite an interesting one. It was definitely needed for the SharePoint world. So the reason OAuth was put into the platform was really based around the new app development model. Because what was the issue? The issue was lots of developers wrote some dodgy code that didn't quite work, and it took the SharePoint server farm down. Not that any developers would write code like that, but it has been known a few people have experienced that. And then they introduced Sandbox for 2010, and no one liked writing Sandbox solutions. And if they did, then it was very complicated. And so this time around, they decided, well, you know what? Let's take a leap out of everybody else's book. Let's abstract everything away, and let's implement a trust base. So I can store something in Windows Azure, I can store it inside SharePoint, I can store it on an IIS website somewhere and have it communicate to SharePoint directly and access its content, but it's only via a trusted token that gets created. So OAuth, what's the definition of OAuth? Well, OAuth enables users to approve an application for specific permissions. I can create an OAuth application that has permissions to just a list or just the web, or just a document library. I can say, you have to have permissions. And when the end user goes to click it, it'll say, hey, hey, do you trust this? Yes, I do. Because inherently, we all just press yes. It's like nobody ever reads the Microsoft agreements when they install something, do they? No, that's it, you're all laughing. You don't. I've never read, I know you do. I've never read one. I get like the first line, I'm like, yeah, I'm bored now. So I don't read them. OAuth is used for access tokens. It's not authentication. Don't think it's a replacement for authentication. It's access token request. That's what it's built for. It's an abstraction of the authorization components. That's all it is. Because your authentication process will actually have already been done, because you will be on the inside of SharePoint, you will have already authenticated, and when you happen to go out to get the application, it's going to create a special token, a client context, because remember, it runs in an iframe. I'll have a diagram for this. It goes in an iframe, and a client context gets created and secured between the STS, and then it throws it back out. So I'll show you that in a second. So what can it be used for? Specific site, specific resource, and define duration. This is fantastic. Create an application that uses OAuth and define it's only allowed for a certain duration of time. So maybe you want to have an application that, you know, allows users to vote, for example. You can now say, well, when you log in, you authorized, but your authorization token will expire in 8 hours from now. And then if it's 8 hours and 1 minute, they won't be able to get back in. They'll have to reauthorize themselves. And then, of course, the great thing about this is it enables users to grant applications access to information in SharePoint. And that's the key, to grant permission. And what's cool is it's not the same account as they have. It's not an elevated account. It's an authorization token that happens to have permission based on the trust identity that you've passed to get in. It's all sandboxed. So that permission is not an elevated context. So, what about the app model? The application model is the great one. This is the one that everybody's talking about. It's the same idea that Facebook does when you create an application for Facebook, and or you want to log into your website with Twitter or Facebook, and you get that box that says, do you wish to authorize this? And you say yes. That's an OAuth process taking place then. It's used for application requests. It's also used along with Windows Azure ACS, because you can store stuff based in there. It's for internal app authorization. It's a great platform to use. What are the permissions that we have? It's based on trust. I know that sounds really bad. I trust you. That's really what it is. If you don't trust them, if you don't trust the app, don't press the button. That's all that takes. You go to the store and you say, ooh, I want to download the Nintex trial into my environment. If you really don't want to trust it, then don't press trust it. It's as simple as that. The power's back with you as the IT admins now to be able to go in and say, I trust this, and this is now available in the catalog for my end users to use. If you don't trust it, don't trust it.
You didn't see the other sessions, but does the app model have resource thresholding?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, you'll actually do some of that on the SharePoint side instead of the authorization process, but yeah. Where did I get to? So what are there's three app types. The three that will be there, if you're in Visual Studio, you'll see these three, or you need to know this. If you're not a dev, you need to know this anyway, because you'll be the ones that will have to configure these three app types. You have the cloud-hosted. This is Windows Azure. This is the automatic, magical one, where you go into Visual Studio and say, hosted, and it goes off and wires everything for you in Windows Azure, and you get really funny URLs, but that's where that goes. Then you have the SharePoint-hosted, more secure a little bit because it's hosted in your environment. So this is where you have internal developers and you want to make them code things you to use authorization as against runners elevated. You can host them in a separate web app inside SharePoint and it will dynamically create the URLs in your domain with those applications on. And then, of course, you have the provider hosted, which is I'm building a .NET website kind of app. I want to just host that on an IIS website. Those are the three. Those are important. The three different models. If you want to keep it inside, then you're not going to use the Azure hosted one. So how does the process work? So this one's a little bit more complicated. So in this scenario, we have me at the bottom. That's what I look like on the weekends. And then, of course, we have SharePoint. We have the STS, which in this case is Windows Azure, because I'm just going to use the Azure one as the example, but that could be the internal SharePoint STS. And then I have a hosted web, which is just going to host my application. So this is the hosted model that I'm going to go through, but it's exactly the same process. So the first one is, I actually make a request to the SharePoint site. I go, HTTP SharePoint, and I make a request. Now, what actually happens is, when I actually hit the SharePoint says, well, hold on a minute, you've got something hosted in the page. So I can't return that yet, because I don't have any permission or authorization to do that. So it makes a request to the STS, which is Windows Azure, and says, hold on a minute, I need to authorize this process. So what it does, it goes, It authorizes you. It creates a specific context security token. And what that means is that's specific to you as the individual who's gone to that iframe that's supposed to be there. Yes, we're using iframes again. It goes there, and it creates a context security token. It throws that to the STS. The STS sends that back and says, right, here's the signed token. And if you actually do a fiddler trace and can decrypt the SSL tokens, it's just a massive kind of GUID with a whole bunch of characters and a bunch of other stuff that gets sent. The iframe then tries to render the SharePoint page again. So you got the frame, you got the SharePoint page and the frame. It tries to render it, and this time it passes the context signed token. It goes, okay, hold on a minute, let's make a request again. Oh, I've got this with me. And it makes the request again. The request is then made from SharePoint to the hosted app, which in this scenario is going to be Windows Azure, so it's in the cloud, and it sends everything with it. Once it's gone back to that, there we go. Once you've gone all the way around and the page starts to load, then the STS intervenes again, and this time it goes and gets, it validates the context token that you sent it the first time. Now it issues a secret. Special secret handshake, just for you, just for your request. So you have a special client context and a magical handshake that take place. When they take place, then this is the magical piece. It takes the tokens that you've got and caches them. This is fantastic in 2013. 2013, distributed cache. Everybody been using App Fabric. That's now core to 2013. It now throws all of this into the cache. So you don't have to keep requesting it again and again and again and again and again. Because you've seen this. You've seen this before where you access Summit and it keeps throwing you back to authenticate and back and back and back. This doesn't do that. So once you have the cache token, then finally it issues and then the resource is retrieved. At no point have I passed my credentials anywhere in that process because I'm already validated. I'm already authenticated on SharePoint. The rest is purely authorization tokens. So this is the great abstraction that's added to 2013 now. So any custom components that you now need to build in 2013, you now need to seriously consider using this model to abstract the ability for the end user to have to run in their own context of their account. But also to make the developers not write stuff as elevated. What was elevated code? It runs in the context of the application pool account. And the application pool account has all supreme power to do whatever you want it to do. It's a change and shift of how we do things. So instead of implicitly giving permission, we now trust authorize instead. So, excuse me, server-to-server authorization, a little bit different. This one is really made around for exchange and link. That's really what this was for. The ability to retrieve information inside Outlook from SharePoint without you having to pass credentials all the way back. So we do the same kind of process. We have server to server for SharePoint. ACS uses this model anyway. But what's really cool about this is that the STS inside SharePoint now is a real STS. I say that really weirdly because in 2010 it wasn't really a real one. You didn't really have a federation metadata XML that you could talk to or anything like that. This time around, we do, except they made it slightly more complicated for you. They made it so you have to use JSON now. But you have a JSON endpoint that can be used. And you can configure two completely different SharePoint 2013 farms, have this one over here and this one over here, and trust by using the JSON endpoint, which means that I can now access resources from both without having to credentialize all the way across. Hey, that was a new word, credentialize. I like that. Should use that more often. So, let's go and look at some authorization. Let me just do my... I'm going to get rid of that website. You didn't see that. If anybody asked about the website that was up earlier, it wasn't me. So, I wanted to use ADFS as the example. The reason why is to make sure that I had internet access, because I use it locally. But the principles of ADFS with Windows Azure or Trusted Identity are exactly the same. So, what I've got here is an ADFS implementation. It's very straightforward. I'm using Active Directory. I have an AD on my machine, a separate Active Directory. It has ADFS installed. I have a bunch of users, user accounts. And what I was actually able to do is to create two relying party trusts. Now, in the process flow that we talked about earlier, the relying party, or the RP, is the endpoint you're trying to get to. This is what you type in the browser and say, I want to get to that. So the relying party is there. In ADFS or Windows Azure, anything that's a kind of a SAML-based process, you have to configure the endpoint to accept specific types of authentication and the claims that you're supposed to have. So if I go and look at the properties of my one that's here, you'll see that I have a unique identifier. Move my mouse. I have a unique identifier for my relying party. So what this means is that not anybody can just go to it. Not anybody can just say, well, I'm going to pass a token to it. It needs to contain this. It needs to have, this is the unique identifier. So when I configure it in SharePoint, I say, this is the unique identifier that's needed to get to that. Just as you would with a certificate if you're talking to Facebook or Windows Azure. So we have this process. Then we have, if I come back at this, then we have the actual claims themselves. So if I choose my Active Directory, you'll see that I'm able to configure claims that come from AD and map them into something going out the other way. So what I have here is I have like an email address, I have the user principal name, the Windows account, and the groups. And I'm passing those back. So that means that when somebody goes to my ADFS, my identity provider, and authenticates, this is what I'm going to get. And I'm going to send this back in my encrypted token back to SharePoint. That's what I'm going to send back. Oh, it's this machine. What I also did, though, is what I wanted to be able to do is grab some other information from a different application. So we talked earlier, get some stuff from PeopleSoft, attach it into the claims. In this instance, I have a SQL database. If I do this, I'm not going to explain this yet. I'll explain this in a minute. But what this one does, this goes and gets me a series of values from a SQL database at the point of login, returns the values, and injects them as claims. So when I get to SharePoint, I actually get AD, SQL, squashed together as a claim token. So we'll come back to that in a second. So let me just have a look at how this works inside SharePoint. So here's my SharePoint environment. I'm going to click on Portal. There was my ADFS login. That was a very, very quick ADFS login. And what I'm able to do is if I actually look within the Claims Viewer web part, let me just, yeah, this one always spits out a lot of stuff. Okay, you'll see that I've authenticated via ADFS, Active Directory. I've gone all the way through and got my AD creds at the top. All that stuff that we, email address, user principal name, Windows account name. And then you'll see date of birth, badge ID, desk location, car registration. Those are from SQL Server. Those are from a completely different source. So I now have Windows and a mashup of a SQL attribute store presented together as an object. So what does it actually present? Because claims are very cool. It's just effectively a piece of XML. So what you end up with is if I go and look at the raw SAML token itself, you'll see right here, this is just a piece of XML that gets presented back. But it's encrypted with an X509 certificate, which is a certificate that was generated on ADFS and that we trusted inside SharePoint. So just because you have ADFS doesn't mean that SharePoint's going to let you log in. You need to actually have not only the configuration, you also need to have the certificate trusted, so you trust the cert, the signing cert from the ADFS. If you're using Windows Azure, it's exactly the same process. So if I go back into my SharePoint environment, let's come back out of SharePoint, go back to my ADFS environment, sorry. So in my ADFS environment, if I go back to my claims, you'll notice here in the tabs that we have an issuance transform rules, and then we have an authorization transform rules. So we talked about the process. The issuance ones is where the transformation takes place, and then we present those back to SharePoint. The authorization ones are ones where we're able to go into the authorization. At the moment, I've set that to permit access to everybody. But in the real world, you might not want to do that. You might actually want to go in and say permit or deny based on a value. I can pick one of the claims that's been presented and say I would like to deny access or permit access based on a claim attribute that you have. So we're not relying on the fact that you've authenticated now. whoopee-doo-da that you've authenticated. Now we're going to say, do you have the right claim? Yes or no? Excuse me. So if I go back to my SQL claims. Now, ADFS has this magical language, which looks like this, which is very straightforward. It tells me that I'm generating specific claim types that are coming back out. And these are my own types. So the first thing it tells me is, go and get the email address claim. Because you have one coming from AD, get the email address claim. Then it validates and says, well, do you have one? Yes, I do. And then it goes in and says, use this specific store, which in my instance is a SQL store, and it'll say, go and generate me these four specific claim types, which are made up ones. Then it will do a SQL select statement. Go and get me this, and then populates all those values, and then injects those back into the claim output. So what we now have is this syntax can be replicated for anything. So if I look at the authorization claim that I'd created, here's a different one. I go into SQL and I get level 1, level 2, level 3, which is from a different SQL database, and I inject those into the claim also. So what does that mean? Well, that means when you go to SharePoint and you go to the people picker, that means you will see these in the people picker, and they will resolve to whatever you want it to be, and you can then apply permission to them. So you don't have to apply permission to an end user account. Too often in SharePoint, that's what we've done. We've created like an AD group and put users in, and we've applied permission to an AD group, or we've applied permission to a person. But actually, in the claims world, we don't have to use any of those. We can just go and say, actually, apply permission based on his date of birth. Is that person 21 or over? If they're not, then don't let them in. If they are, let them in. So we're abstracting security away from what it should be. We're effectively keeping the permissions away from associated to an object like a user. Let me just go back to my... We'll come back to that one in a second. Okay. So, when it comes to protecting content, so we've done the authorization process, we've logged in, we've got our claim attributes. Now, how do we protect the content? Because we've just authenticated. That's all we've done. We've authenticated, we've been authorized. So how are we going to do these things? Well, the first thing we've got as a way of doing it is actually like an old school way. Anybody ever modified a web config and used path locations? Yeah, a few nods there. Path locations were great. You put them in a web config, little question mark, little asterisk star, deny, allow, whatever it's going to be. Kind of old school way of doing it. But we can still do that. You can still do that inside SharePoint. One of the reasons I saw the website that shows me all the view lsts.aspx page is because nobody put in the form page lockdown control and turned it on, and so it's now available, but they could have used location mapping to do the same thing. We can also use user access gateway or any other firewall to do URL path blocking if we needed to. If you're using UAG, you could use a UAG box with ADFS and then use the claims to map to different destination locations using the UAG box. We can do taxonomy classification, and I don't mean the same taxonomy that we use in SharePoint like manage metadata, but you can use, this is a custom code option, but you can say, well, if a piece of content is tagged with X, Y, and Z, then only these people can actually get access to it. And you can control that with custom code. You obviously have permission-based security groups and roles. That's the standard way that we do things. The claim attribute-based. Does the user have X attribute? Or we can do claims augmentation. Now, one of the downsides of claims, not necessarily claims, but SharePoint, it's a downside of SharePoint, and it's still there in 2013, is the ability to combine things together. So we were talking about it earlier, to do with compound claims. The ability to say, well, to access this piece of content, you have to be in this group, and this group, and this group, and this group, and this group. SharePoint doesn't do that. And some of you may have tried that and found out that it doesn't do that. SharePoint works in the processing of or. You're either this, or you're this, or you're this. There's no way of saying, well, I need you to be in this group, and this group, and this group, and then you can see something. It doesn't work that way. But there's ways of making that work. ADFS can do that for you. I'll show you some rules that we can show you how to do that. That we're able to go in and say, well, if the user has X, Y, and Z claims, then present this claim And that's the claim you apply permission to. So you have different mechanisms of doing it. But this is a great one, using claim attributes. And then we have the request management service. The request management service is new to 2013. This allows us to manage request routing between web servers and traffic. But you also have the flexibility of saying, actually, anybody who comes in, I'm going to block PDFs. Not that you would ever do that, of course, because 90% of people's documents are PDFs at some point. But you could block PDF access. You could block, does the request contain this? If it does, then block it out. So, wait for that to refresh. So, if I'm looking at my Active Directory, you'll see the types of claims that we can actually present. So, the first one, we can use regular expressions to actually go through and say, does this attribute contain this piece of content? In the first instance, I'm looking for email address. Does the end of the email address match? If it does, then all I'm doing right now is I'm just returning the email address claim. That's all I'm doing. But I could actually have it return whatever I want it to. I could actually create a new claim at that point and say, call it past email address validation. And then what you would then do is in SharePoint, you would see that in the People Picker. And that's what you would apply permissions to. We also then have a second one, which is a little bit more complicated, where we have to match two claim attributes. Do you have the date of birth claim? Do you have this claim? If you do, then you're allowed to access information. And then, of course, my last one here is, does the email address match an exact match? So you have different ways of doing things. ADFS lets you build this construction, and it works perfectly well with 2007, 2010, 2013. I'm using the new version of ADFS in Windows 2012, but you can do this in all of those backwards, and it works really, really well. I suppose the question I get asked quite a lot is, why would you want to use ADFS? Can we not just implement SharePoint and just use Active Directory? Of course you can. It's a perfect approach. I prefer using ADFS. Why? Because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. You may decide that you want to, well, when my internal user logs into SharePoint, I also want to get more information about them. If you've only got Active Directory login, then you're going to write custom code to get that information for that user. Whereas if you've already built it with ADFS, then you just include this in the claims. It's a little bit easier to manage. So the end user experience is exactly the same. You saw me log in. I didn't get prompted. I didn't get redirected. I didn't go anywhere. I just went open up, thump, and it logged me straight in. And that had actually done, if you look in Fiddler, that had done a bounce all the way through. It had gone from SharePoint, from my browser to SharePoint, all the way across to ADFS, and back, and then back in again. But the end user hadn't seen that. Where did we get to? So what about encrypting the content? Anybody running encryption right now? Anybody paranoid enough that they have to run encryption? Yeah? I had an example once. I worked with a client where they wanted to use information rights management. Information rights management is great. It does encryption. It bolts an encryption right in the header of the object, and you can't break that open without having the right certificate. But they didn't believe me at all. I told them it was fantastic. Microsoft told them it was fantastic, and they didn't believe me. So this was the test. We built a SharePoint farm. We put rights management on the servers. We got a document, created it, signed it with rights management, encrypted it. Everything was working fine. They opened up Word. They connected the document from SharePoint, streamed the document, and when they got the document opened, they turned the machine off. And you think, what do you turn the machine off for? But what does that do? That leaves potentially a decrypted file on the disk. And so they got one of their security hacker guys in to come and try and hack the file. So about an hour later, he got the file off and then spent the next couple of hours trying to hack the file. I had great pleasure because he couldn't hack the file because it was trying to make a request. Every time he tried to do something, it tried to call out and make a request to the certificate that was assigned to it from the rights management infrastructure. So he could not get into the file. And so they implemented rights management services. It's a great addition. But then there are other technologies that are available to us. Rights management, this is what we talked about. It's great. Just add it in. It's for email, it's for SharePoint, it's for a whole bunch of stuff. But seriously consider rights management. It's an extra level of security. BitLocker and EFS. Everybody's going to move to Windows 8 machines, aren't they? Everybody using Windows 8 now? Everybody loving Windows 8? That was very quiet. Are we loving Windows 8? Woo, yeah! But yes, running BitLocker, it's been around for a while. Encrypting the disk, using EFS. But the downside is it just protects the physical location. So you can use this with SQL, for example. It's a bit of an overhead, but it only encrypts the stuff that's on the disk. Once it's off the disk, yeah, not so much. So what about SQL encryption, TDE? Yep, TDE works really well. What's the downside to TDE? If you lose the private key, you can't do anything. And that's I've seen a client do that before. They encrypted everything with TDE and then lost the private key. So when they tried to restore the database, it would ask them for the private key, and there was nothing they could do. And so they say, well, how can we get the data back? I'm like, that's just not going to happen. Just destroy it and don't worry about it. Go back to the first one you ever had. But it works really well. It works great with SharePoint. And it's on a content database by content database. It's not a sweep of everything. No, that's right. So what about protecting the infrastructure? Well, 2013 has some topology. So if you think where we came from, 2003, very prescribed topologies. Very prescribed. It would even complain at you if you got it wrong. 2007, a little bit better, kind of more scale. 2010, still prescribed. What did we get this time? We went to 2013. We still have some prescribed, but this time it's not really based around number of servers as such. It's really based around roles and the things you want those servers to do. We can now scale massively. If you think about it, 2013 was written for what? It wasn't written for on-prem, was it? It was never written for on-prem. We just happened to have an on-prem version. It was written for 365 and in the cloud. So this will scale massively. So what are the different types? Well, we have the limited deployment, which is 1 to 2 servers, which I wouldn't even look at that one unless you're doing dev. Then, of course, you've got your small multipurpose one, which is the 3 to 4 servers. We can talk about the roles that go on there. And then, of course, we have our medium farm. I find it funny how the medium farm is now 6 servers or more, where historically that was nowhere near 6 servers or more. But now we're gradually going. And then, of course, we have medium farm with Office web apps and then search, and we're getting even more now. And then, of course, we have our large deployment, which really is as many as you can throw at it. But that's an interesting point, isn't it? Everything's starting to abstract itself out. So we have dedicated roles. And that's great from security. Because the problem was, we shoved everything together on the same servers, and then when it came to harden the servers, it was a pain in the backside. Because you couldn't harden the servers because you had to open 3 billion ports for anything to work. Now, as we start to abstract things out into their own devices, we're able to now have security policies and analyze the servers to lock things down. So what about edge and perimeter? You should all be great at this one. This is the big one for me. Stop just publishing the Windows login prompt. So many servers. I can use the Shodan HQ website, and every single one that I find, I can do a search for NTLM, and hey presto, it's a Windows login box. Windows login boxes are great if you're in the office or if you're logging into a server. If it's out on the web, that's just begging for a brute force attack because it's there. And everybody knows it's a Windows server as soon as you do that one. So change it. Put something in front of it. Put a firewall in front of it. Do a negotiate. Do a Kerberos delegation. Use a UAG box. Use a Cisco box. Use something that will offload that authentication and not be a Windows login prompt. Utilize firewalls. UAG is great. Obviously, we used to have TMG, and TMG disappeared, and now it's UAG and a whole bunch of other names. But use those technologies that are available. Use whatever firewall technology you've got. Make sure that it works with SharePoint. Too often, I see SharePoint get published as if it's a normal website. It's not. It's not a normal website. Anybody who thinks SharePoint is normal? Yeah, I didn't think so. SharePoint's not normal. It's very, very special, and it needs a bit of love and tenderness in order for it to work properly. and just publishing it like a website, saying, shove me port 80 all the way to that server. That's going to be great. And that means I can see everything. Because then what are you relying on? You're relying on the security being correct. Because your firewall's just funneling everything to it. Put something in front of it. Use multi-factor authentication. Certificate services, this is a great one. Put certificates on the client side, let them log in. Use something else. Use an air gap between the two environments. Use ADFS. That works really, really well because now your authentication is away from SharePoint. Use an identity provider, something that will move those two apart from each other. Load balance the traffic. And my note here is you don't need sticky sessions now, which means if I've got four servers and I hit the first server and the first server blows up and I get redirected to the second server, I'm not going to get a reauthentication process. Which is great, because it never used to do that. You would have to get a reauth the second time, a reauth the third time, unless you'd coded it in a way that it wouldn't do that. Now we throw it all the FedAuth tokens, everything, goes straight into the cache, and you can just keep going and going and going. So what about the web apps? So we've done kind of edge, firewall, the web apps themselves. Block standard SQL Server ports. How many people are running SQL Server as standard SQL ports? No one's going to confess.
No, I'm not running it, yeah.
1433 and 1434, those are the two ports that it needs, TCP and UDP. Configure SQL databases to listen on non-standard ports. I know what they are, so does everybody else. I can go online and download a tool, it's called SQL Map, and I can just sniff for SQL servers, and it looks for those specific ports that are open. Yep, SQL Blast is another one. You can use Nmap. There's a whole bunch of them. Configure SQL aliases. If you are not using SQL aliases in your SharePoint environment, naughty, 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 naughty. You should be using SQL aliases. Why? Because if your SQL server dies, you don't have to go and change the name of everything. You just change the alias to point to the other SQL server that you need to build. SQL aliases should be used. It's actually a practice that is now recommended. Implement Windows firewall policies. Who turns off the Windows firewall? On the servers. Yeah. I turn them off sometimes, but they're mostly my demo machines. But no, we should leave them on. It was there for a reason. It's there to protect the server. Yes, you may have to go through and do some little special kind of work. What you may have to do is turn off the one for domain, so turn off the domain policy, but leave the public and the private ones on. Leave them on. That's what it's there for. Implement firewall layers between everything. This one's a hard one. This one takes some very special love and care to get this right. Web app layers, firewall, web apps, firewalls, apps, firewalls, servers. But it works. It means you have to be a really clever hacker to get through every single layer. And it means that you can at any point just go, kill it. And no one can get in. If you don't have that, if I can compromise a web front end and you have no firewalls to block me going through, you have very big issues because you can hop all the way through one by one. Use the best practice security analyzer and use the hardening guidelines from Microsoft. And if you really want to have fun, read the STIG documents. If you really don't sleep at night, read those. They'll help you sleep. Or you could even do some really hardcore stuff. Use group policies. We should be using group policies. We should be controlling what the servers do. If the servers don't need internet access, don't give them internet access. I'm surprised how many times I go on a SharePoint server and it has full internet access. Does it need it? Does it ever talk to the internet? Hopefully not. Does it need updates? Because hopefully if you're patching correctly, you'll be managing that anyway. So it doesn't need internet access, does it? Switch it off. Control access to those servers. And utilize claim attributes. This is the big one. Use these at that level. This is the protection that you're going to put in place. So, infrastructure. Everyone likes to talk about ports, blocking the ports, opening the ports, whatever it might be. So, port 80 and 443, HTTP and HTTPS. You obviously have to open those, otherwise no one's going to get to your SharePoint site. You will have the most secure SharePoint environment in the world if you don't open these two ports. You're going to need UDP 1434 and TCP 1433, depending on your infrastructure, but you're going to need these to be able to get SQL, and the SharePoint servers have to speak to SQL. I always tell people, if your SQL server doesn't work, you have no SharePoint. I'm waiting for the day, I joked the other day, I said I was waiting for the day when SharePoint becomes a role of SQL Server. That you just install SQL Server and say, SharePoint, like SQL Reporting Services is. Because it really is SQL Server. SQL Server doesn't work, you have nothing. TCP 25, SMTP, you may need that, you may not. If you're using email, incoming, whatever it might be, you'll need that port open to those SharePoint servers. File and print sharing, you may need these ones. TCP UDP 445, this is some of the pieces that are used internal to SharePoint. You also may need the NetBIOS ones, but really you shouldn't have to use those. Then, of course, communication between the web servers and the service applications. HTTP binding is done internally using these ports. And if you want to see what these ports are, go and get a network sniffer and stick it between the SharePoint servers and have fun. Just watch it all the way down, because SharePoint's very chatty to every element of SharePoint. You're going to need HTTPS binding. You may need NetTCP. And then you also have potentially Kerberos communication that needs to take place between the SharePoint server and the services. And then Kerberos change password. You may need that port also. There's a lot of ports. There's even more than this. There's a few more that I didn't want to put on here because they're very specific scenarios. But we're talking about security now. Too often, no one does anything. They put SharePoint in. They stick a firewall in front of it, and it's done. No one goes through the process of investigating what needs to be blocked. Does that server actually have to talk to that server? Why? Because it's too much effort. But this is important. We live in a world. So here's the question. See who knows the answer. The Kindle Fire, the very first time, was launched. How long did it take for the Kindle Fire to get hacked? Anyone remember the anyone remember? 4 hours. 4 hours. Amazon have got some smart people. They got some really clever people. Yet somebody was smarter than they were and managed to hack and root the Kindle Fire in 4 hours. There's always somebody else out there who's way smarter than you. And me. Who's always going to figure out a way of getting around something. So, what about compliance? How does compliance come into the equation? You may have regulatory compliance, state, government, all those different things. You'll have all these different things that you may have to adhere to. You may have content appliance. You may be using records management. If you're not using records management right now, and you have a lot of content that really should be archived, I'll encourage you to use records management. Encourage you to go and create retention policies, create record centers, and move the stuff from where it is into locations where it's restricted and locked down. It's a great addition to the SharePoint platform. It's getting better and better. There was a session earlier on this week about e-discovery. Great one. That's how that all plays together. We live in a world now where at a moment's notice, somebody might issue a legal case against you. Can you get to all the content? Is it all restricted enough? Or when the end user finds out it involves him, is he going to delete all the stuff? And you can't get it. You've got to think those things through. So what about protection? Who are we protecting ourselves against? Staff, number one. You're protecting yourself against yourselves. I'm one of those people, and I'm sure there's lots of people in the room who are like this, where the first thing I try to do is get to something. Who's ever gone to a file share and just double-clicked until they find one they can get into?
Yeah, I've done it.
Yeah. Oh, access denied. I wonder what's in there. It's that wondering thing. Doesn't mean you're a hacker. It just means that you're inquisitive. And so when it comes to SharePoint, SharePoint's just like a file share. Can I get to that one? Click, click, click. Oh, yes, I can. That's what I do. I go into the Sheldon HQ. I do a search. I find a website and go, check it out. I've just found a list of emails and passwords. I'm not trying to hack anyone, then it makes me think, who's looking after that infrastructure? That's the staff. They need to worry about that. Vendors, partners, anonymous users, the kid who lives in the house next door to you. who's a little script kiddie who goes online, downloads a Perl script, and hacks everything out your SharePoint site. It's been done. There's tools available to do this. There's never going to be a point where you can stop them, ever. You need to accept that. You need to accept that you can do everything within your power to secure a SharePoint environment, and you're not going to be able to stop them. Because somebody will always find a way, and you have to leave it to Microsoft and the security teams and the researchers to find out how to mitigate those things. Protection is only as good as what you implement. If you implement badly, then you have a problem. This is a good one. Log the traffic. Now in 2013, authentication requests, FedAuth token requests are all logged inside SharePoint. 2010 didn't do that. There was no login. It just went, they logged in. There was nothing else. Now we can even find out what made them log out, what was the reason why they were rejected, and all that information is now stored inside SharePoint. So we can run reports on this one. Who reviews their firewall logs on a weekly basis? Who even knows they have firewall logs? Who reviews the server logs on a weekly basis? Or do you review it when someone says there's an issue with the server? And then you look at the event logs and look through everything. This should be an active thing. And implement alerting mechanisms for potential breaches. We've seen lots of this recently. You would think people like Sony would have great security for their PlayStation network, wouldn't you? Apparently not. Apparently they weren't so clever. This is the biggest one. Misconfiguration is your number one enemy. Misconfiguration. The site that I showed you earlier, it's because it's misconfigured. But they don't know that. And nobody's obviously told them that it's misconfigured. There's a website. Let me see if I can get this one. So let's go with this one. So I'm going to leave this there for a second so you can get the idea of what I've done. And it's going to go away. That's a website that's available. It's a SharePoint site. Hundreds of thousands of people go to that website every single day. And I can rip out all the email addresses in one go. That's a tool that I wrote. Thank you. But yeah, that's misconfiguration. That's not somebody maliciously not, you know, doing something. It just means it was configured incorrectly. That should not be available. I should not be able to go to the user disk page in SharePoint as an anonymous user. If you go to Google or Bing, whichever one you want to go to, you can go to Google and do a very constructed search, and I can get every website that's exposing the user disk page. For those that don't know, the user disk page is user profile information. Email addresses, login accounts, all kinds of stuff that might be there. I can iterate through that. It's not hard. This is what you're trying to protect against. If you have this private information, people's email addresses are very special. Like, it's mine. It's my email address. You don't want other people getting those and then spamming them with all kinds of stuff that they don't want to get. So if there's loads of websites out there, so you think you're secure, test your security. If you want to test the stuff yourself, if you don't want to pay for a pen test firm, go and download a VM that you can get. It's called Backtrack. Go and have a look for it. It has all the pen test tools and exploit tools that you'll ever need to go through and test environments. Test security from the inside. Test it like an end user. Stop testing it because like an admin. Have an admin account and a user account and test it like a user. When the user says it doesn't work, don't log it as an admin and go, well, it works for me. Of course it's going to work for you. You're the admin. Log in as a user and test that same process. And of course, test the search results. This is the first one I always do. What is in the search results that you lot didn't clean out? Test pages, things that you shouldn't have wrote that was just for testing. Clean those out before you launch. Go in and test security from the outside. This is your ticket to be a hacker for the day. Tell your boss you're going to be a hacker for the day and make sure that everything's tight. And then go and try and hack your SharePoint environment. Tell people to do that all the time. Because if you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. And they might not be as nice as you are. They might decide to rip everything down and put a nice little message on there. Use pen testing tools, some great ones. Nmap, W3AF is another tool. It's quite a good one. W3AF, you can leave it going for about an hour, and it will interrogate everything out of your SharePoint environment or web or ASP.NET website or PHP website or whatever it's going to be. Just leave it running. And if you're concerned about somebody realizing that it's your network that's doing it, then download the Tor project and do it anonymously. Then nobody will know that it's you. Always be on your guard. Not that I'm giving you tricks of how to get around it, but if you don't know how to do it, how can you protect against it? Always be on your guard. So what are the final thoughts? Four things. How? Ask yourself how. And what I mean by how is how are the people going to get in? So you're building a SharePoint infrastructure. How do you want them to come in? Are they just internal? Are they external? Are they partners? Are they vendors? Are you using ADFS? Are you using just Windows? Are you using forms-based? Are you using some other mechanism? Ask yourself how they're going to do this. What I like to do for this is draw a process flow diagram. I draw my SharePoint server, and I say, these ones, these ones, these ones, these ones, these ones. This is where they come from. Then that gives me, effectively, personas to work with. I have my employee. I have my vendor. I have whatever it's going to be. Identify who they are with the personas. Internal, external, public, whatever it's going to be. And then when? When are they coming in? The reason you ask yourself when is so you know what to look for. Are they going to be just business hours? Well, if they are, then you know if you suddenly get alerts at midnight that something's going wrong. That it's not just Joe Bloggs trying to get into the site. So you need to work out when, how, and when they're going to come in. Restrict the login hours if you need to. Say, we're going to be East Coast, nobody else is coming in, it's an extranet for partners, they're all on the East Coast, so let's restrict it outside of specific hours. That will mitigate some of the attacks that you might get. And of course, last but not least, why? Ask yourself, why are they coming to the site? Too often, we're very, very quick to stand everything up with no real why. We just want to do it. It's like, yeah, SharePoint's cool, let's do it. And I'm a great advocate of that. But you kind of think this process through a bit more. Why do they want to come in? Is it a public site? Is it anonymous users? Is it extranet? Is it collaboration? What's it going to be? Ask yourself those four things. If you ask yourself these four things and then work through the process of securing your environment, everything will be fine. Because you will be getting alerts. It'll be secured properly. It'll be restricted. You'll have great performance. And if something does happen, you will know about it. And then when your boss comes in and says, our website was down for 3 days, you'd be like, yes, I know. It's those people hacking the site again. And to mitigate that, we put this box in front of it. It saw it as a denial of the service, and it switched it off. You'll get a pat on the back for that because you were able to mitigate somebody coming into the site. 2013 goes a long way in the infrastructure, the scalability and performance of that, but then there's a gap. That's you guys. You guys are the gap. You have to secure the environment. SharePoint natively does a deny. But of course, what's in SharePoint 2013 now? The share option. Click share. I want to share it with the world. That makes your job significantly more complicated because now you have to manage the ability for an end user to share it with 50,000 people if they feel like it. And you have to worry about that. Well, how are those 50,000 people going to get in? That's why these questions are here. How, who, why, and when. That will determine and give you the best design. So, thank you for attending the session. Hope you got something out of it. Make sure you fill your evals out, and I'll actually be over at the Ask the Experts booth in the next few minutes.